In 1971, you launched the UROC radio show on KFIG-FM, correct?
That's correct.
What were your playlists like in those early days? In the early days of the radio show, what kind of stuff were you playing?
Well, the early days of FM weren't exactly playlisted.
Yeah.
My show was fairly structured in the sense that the guy who got me on the air, Ray Appleton, and I would get together on, like, say, Monday or either Friday before the week of the show, and we would get in the control room, and I would bring to him some records, and we would play the records, and he would record. We would DJ like 15 seconds of music here and 10 seconds of music there. I'd write some copy, he'd record it. We actually spliced and taped promotional spots of about a minute every week, and I would just pick records from, you know, my collection, so to speak, that I wanted to play each week, which were all basically kind of imported from Virgin Records' very first little micro store in Lodbrook Grove. They were an import only from European continent or cosmic, French rock, everything.
Yeah.
So when we got to the show, which was on a Wednesday evening, I would bring in the records. We would play the spot, and we would do an hour prime time with a couple commercials only, like maybe at 20 minutes and 40 minutes. And we would have breaks in between the music where people would call and ask questions, or, you know, we could take questions while we weren't on the air even, when we were playing the music. I do have some interesting stories from those days. You interested in that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which would reflect on your playlist question. In particular, I was had a friend go to meet the Cosmic Couriers in 73, and I had gotten a whole lot of their music. So we did a program with Klaus Schulze, second album, Cyborg, you know, the double album. And this was kind of like innovative radio in the sense that we had two turntables. We played side one and side four simultaneously.
Huh.
So it was going out over the airwaves, and since there were different undulating rhythms in each piece, but they were in the same key, we had people call us up and said, "Man, what is this that you're playing? I've never heard anything like this." So, of course, I explained to them who the Cosmic Couriers were, who Klaus Schulze were, and they were just... It was like mind-blowing. If you could imagine hearing Klaus Schulze in 1972, I think is when that record came out, 71 or 72, and then hearing two sides simultaneously, you probably never even heard that now in 2016, right?
For sure, yeah.
That was the way we sort of began with the electronic Amandul, Can, Klaus Schulze stuff. And then one of the most amazing programs that I ever gave was when I realized that there was something about music that transcended all other forms of communication. As we played, I had gotten a package back from a friend who went to meet the Cosmic Couriers, and they gave me a promotional copy of Hosanna Mantra.
Yeah.
So we did a Popol Vuh program. We tended to focus on like one or two bands per hour. So it was intensive immersion radio, in a sense, which is the way FM was, even if it was somewhat commercial in the early days. So I began with something from Offenstunde, and then played a lot of, if not the whole album, of Hosanna Mantra. So about 20 minutes into the show, a woman called, and she said, "You know, I have a baby that's been crying and teething, has gone into acidosis," which is what happens when babies do this, "for like over a day and a half. And I had your program on, I was listening, and when you put on that music that you were just playing, the quiet lullaby stuff, within 5 minutes the child went to sleep."
Wow.
"And I think I can go to sleep now too, because I have not slept for 2 days. So, like, I think I'll say thank you very much." Who was that anyway?
And I said,
"Popol Vuh." Hosanna Mantra, which is based on the Beatitudes out of the Bible, and it's sacred music from Germany. That thank you very much. I'm going to go to sleep now. I'll listen again next week. And I said, thank you very much for turning in, and I'm glad we were able to help you with your child. I know how hard that can be to have babies. So that was, at that point in time, I thought, man, you're on to something here. I didn't know what it was. I knew who the cosmic couriers were. I had a background in music all the way back to, you know, 1950s radio and being a music guy, you know, playing it in my fifth grade class, rock and roll during music time when they were burning records down south. So the probably the coolest thing for me was Ray, Manfred Mann's Earth Band was in town. They were playing a concert. And he had Manfred over to dinner at his house, and the program was on. So he turned on the show, and they were listening during dinner. And Manfred said to him, man, what is this program? I've never heard this. This is like I've never heard this music. It's so incredible.
Yeah.
He said, oh, that's this show called Yurok that a friend of mine does for us. And it turned out that what I was playing was Embryo Stygos and Rock Session albums, which of course featured Jimmy Jackson, Mal Waldron, and all these incredible jazz people. I don't know if you were familiar with those records, but having Manfred Mann tell Ray that my show was the greatest thing he'd ever heard, how could I, you know, what could I say? I can't go anywhere up or, right, or down, whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I think you probably want to hear about the magazine too, right?
Yeah, I do want to get to the magazine, but before we get to that, I wanted to ask you, you know, that you mentioned you knew you were onto something, but you weren't sure exactly what it was just yet. What was it, though, about the kind of music you were playing, this psychedelic, ambient, open format music from Europe? What was it about these groups and their approach that appealed to you?
Well, it basically took from the root of psychedelia, San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, and, you know, Pink Floyd. And what the amazing thing was is it wasn't English music so much as the German space rock, krautrock, arose from the roots of Germany, the Second World War, the Blitzkrieg. You could hear that sense of psychological makeup in these young musicians who were probably babies or at the time that was happening. The French music was entirely different. So I heard a culture, you know, the U.S. culture, the British culture, sure, but German and France and Italy and Spain, as it turned out, and later even Russia, was the most mind-blowing thing. I began to understand, like, what culture and what music, how it evolved, how it intermingled, and there's something much more than just what you're hearing. There's a history there. There's a power and a way to motivate and to understand life from it, actually.
Yeah. Before we get to the fanzine, the magazine, you had some interactions with the film director, Michael Mann. Was that a result of the radio show?
Actually, no. That was quite a bit down the road. The radio show was like 71 through 74, probably.
Yeah.
The magazine was 73. In the late 70s, I went up to Intergalactic Trading Company in Portland, Oregon, and we began importing en masse all of this music that I was talking about. When I got to L.A. in 1979 or 80, I was working at Green World Limited and running Paradox Music Mail Order, which took the concept of intergalactic, of music around the world, and made it much larger and reached out to the entire country. on wholesale and retail. So I got a phone call from Michael Mann to the office of Green World asking for Archie Patterson. And I said, and they said, hey, Archie, somebody's in, wants to talk to you on the phone. I said, okay. So I got on the phone and he says, hi, this is Michael Mann. And I thought, Michael Mann, okay, where do I know that from? Because he hadn't done a whole lot of films before, before Thief, right? He said, hey, I have heard about Yurok. I said, oh, great. And I am doing a film that stars Jimmy Caan and is sort of a comeback for Tuesday Weld. And I hear you're involved in all this music from Europe. And I said, yeah. He said, what I would like you to do is make me some cassettes, maybe two 90-minute cassettes of music that you think would be related to the concept of the film Thief, which was, I won't go into that, but he wanted sort of dark, intense, powerful, otherworldly music or something like this. As he gave me a description of it, and he gave me a description of the film. I said, okay, I tell you what, why don't you give me a couple, 2 weeks, let me put together a couple tapes, and I'll come into Paramount Studios, and we can talk about it. He says, okay, great. So 2 weeks later, I put together two 90-minute tapes of Faust, Tangerine Dream, Cannes, Almond Duel, you know, all kinds of sort of the more intense, maybe even Magma at that point in time, too, just intense kind of dark music, okay? I went into his, drove into Paramount, got on the lot, and went into his office, and Jerry Goldsmith was in there, too. Not that I really knew who Jerry Goldsmith was at the time, but he introduced me. Those two guys were sitting there, and he said, so what do you got for us? Here, we've got a tape deck. Let's put it on and listen to a little bit of it. So I kind of played a little bit of this. I remember specifically I played some Faust first. That was at the beginning. And then probably the beginning of the second tape was Tangerine Dream. And then I had the Almond Duel and the other things mixed in there. And he goes, huh, I like some of this. What do you think? And then Goldsmith said, yeah. He said, I don't know, it's exactly what we want, but it's close. It's real close. I like the guitar. I like the electronics. I don't like the really dark electronics, right? So why don't you leave these with us, and why don't you go back and try making one more tape that, you know, has another smattering of stuff that you think might relate to this. And he said, this is going to be a dark film about a guy who is a gangster, and he tries to put his life together, the perfect life together with this perfect woman, and then it falls apart and everything kind of goes to hell.
Yeah.
I said, okay, all right. So I came back and we did some more listening, and he said, you know, I think what I want to use is Tangerine Dream.
Yeah.
Because it sounds amazing. And it's got that rhythmic, that aggressive thing, and it's got the dark stuff, and when he does his guitar, I said, yeah. He said, so how can we get in touch with these guys? And I said, well, you know, I've got an address and I've got a phone number in Berlin. And he said, well, why don't you get in touch with them? And I said, well, honestly, I have a new kid and I'm working a job, and it's like you could probably easily contact them. Well, they did. I didn't realize that I turned down a career that could have led me to something else, but I was I was young then, you know. What did I know? And I had a new kid, and it's like, oh, boy, okay.
Sure.
I don't regret it. But interestingly enough, a side note, Michael Mann, I read something of him lately after Edgar died, and he said, you know, I remember, this is how I learned out the upshot of all this, is I remember when we got turned on to Tangerine Dream, and then I went to Berlin, and I was in the studio with Edgar when he was recording the music for Thief.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
I've actually sort of tried to approach Michael Mann out of the blue to say, hey, Michael, hey, I'm doing my own film now. How you want to help? You want to help out? Good luck with that, right?
Yeah. So in the there might be an alternate world in which Michael Mann used who knows, Faust or Amandul or something in an alternate universe. Maybe that stuff would have turned him on. It's hard to say.
You know what? I think he wanted Tangerine Dream, and when I, you know, he invited me to the screening of the film, and he thanked everybody,
yeah.
and I watched it.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, you know what? That nailed it.
Yeah, sure, sure.
If you know that movie, if you're familiar with that movie, Tangerine Dream music makes that movie. And that's another thing I realized at the time, and I always sort of knew this, is like when you watch a film, whatever it is, the music brings it alive. You know, it adds depth,
yeah.
it adds drama, it adds horror and terror and, you know, crying and love and emotion. So that's what's magic about music. It's pure
sure.
magic. It gives you this, and nothing else can give you that, really.
Yeah. So what inspired the transition into a magazine, an early kind of fanzine? What inspired your transition into that world from the radio world? And the...
Yeah. I met a guy named Greg Shaw,
mm-hmm.
who initiated the concept of rock journalism in the Bay Area when he wrote for the Oracle, and then he founded a fanzine called Who Put the Bomb?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I got in touch with him, and he had an incredible issue about Lester Bangs' 30-page riff on the Troggs and all this, you know.
Sure.
We would talk on the phone every once in a while. I ended up meeting him in L.A. at the ELO press party at one point, but he said, I told him that what I was, you know, passionate about. He said, you know what? You should do your own thing. Do a fanzine on it. Anybody can be a publisher. Anybody can do your thing. And he said, you
right.
understand this stuff. You have an affinity for it. Write about it. Find somebody
right.
else to write about it. So I thought, why not? So I started, the first issue was published on the Ides of March, 1973. The program began on the radio program began on the Ides of March, 1971.
Huh.
And I had a friend who was worked in a law office as a janitor, his dad's law office. I had a manual typewriter. I typed it all up, used whiteout to correct the errors, stenciled letters and stuff on it, gave it
yeah.
to him, and every night while he janitored his father's office, he would Xerox some pages for me.
Sure.
So after about 2 weeks, he brought them to me. I laid them out on the floor and hand-collated and stapled them and took one ad out, classified in the back of Rolling Stone, and from the rest is history.
Yeah. And so the magazine ran until when did the magazine cease? Was it the early 80s?
It went till 1990, actually.
Right, right.
And when I was in L.A., the Michael Mann era, it was on the newsstands and around L.A., it developed the more glossy covers, the more artistic Bosch collage covers and stuff. And
yeah.
actually, hilariously enough, it was actually on the set of Mork and Mindy. There was a record store, and right next to the register, there was a magazine rack, and about four issues of Yurok were right on the rack, so when you... Mark was behind the register, and they showed the scene. They shot scenes of him talking. You could see Yurok right on TV.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Pretty funny. Pretty funny, man.
So, in the 80s, you were instrumental in the distribution and proliferation of music associated with early cassette DIY culture, which we talked a little bit about the American Cassette Culture box set.
Yep.
But groups and artists like the Tone Set or Galen, who coincidentally is from Phoenix, which is where I am, and so I'm familiar
yep.
with the Tone Set stuff. That stuff's fantastic. But also
yep.
Steve Roach, who lives here in Tucson,
yep.
Kay Lehmer, who I've interviewed, all these people. And through your distribution network, you know, you were really responsible for getting a lot of that out into the world and connecting people in a sort of pre-internet way. Can you describe the sort of experimental underground DIY scene at that time for me?
Well, it was incredibly diffuse because, as you said, there was no internet. So
yeah.
everything was like snail mail or occasional
yeah.
long-distance phone calls to Germany or France or England or something like that. You know, basically, all I can say is what appeared to happen is once I started the magazine, and then I worked in the business of selling, and then my name became known everywhere.
Yeah.
Around the entire globe, from Russia to Spain to Australia. And I would just get packages sent to me with tapes and with, you know, EPs and LPs to sell, which I initially did through Intergalactic and Green World Paradox. But ultimately, it was like they always wanted to sell more commercial music, and I really had this interest in this cultural music. This, it was, to me, it, in a way, it was like an offshoot of the 60s revolution, which descended into drugs and stupidity.
And sure,
music
sure.
Remained pure. The music was always pure, you know, whether it was fueled by drugs or not, it was pure, and it was a timeless message. So I got all of these things, and really the thing that, in a way, crystallized all this was is I had a tape smuggled out of Czechoslovakia through Canada to me that arrived in a package. And it was by the Plastic People of the Universe, who were actually a band. They refused to get a license because you had to get an audition for a license, and they didn't, so they got thrown in jail. And they wanted me to release this. That was the first release on the Yurok DIY cassette label called The 100 Points, which was 100 points about what second culture and what freedom and what music and what life outside of, you know, the totalitarian system should be like. And I published that and got in touch with other people because of that. And then I realized something else. Actually, the 100 points turned out to be fundamental and the theoretical basis in some sense for Charter 77, which led to the overthrow of the Czech government, and the first president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel, was involved in that. And I realized, wow, there's something going on here that's way more than just something that makes films more powerful. There's something here, and this is when I tied into that Plato quote, musical innovation is full of danger to the state, for when the modes of music change, the fundamental laws of the state always change with them.
Yeah.
He didn't mean music was a great power for better. He was warning against the power of music.
Sure.
The whole context for me became clear when I got that second, you know, when the Plastic People's album, which was also smuggled out of the country into France, was released, and this whole second culture concept was spelled out in a document. I thought, wow, the whole world, you know, is in for trouble.
So that idea, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just realized that the power of music was more than I could even comprehend.
Yeah. So that idea of second culture has continued to define your work from there on. Could you spell out the idea of second culture for readers who might not be familiar with it?
Absolutely. I have one paragraph that epitomizes the whole concept of second culture. The aim of the underground is the creation of a second culture, one that will not be dependent on the official channels of communication, social recognition, and the hierarchy of values laid down by the establishment. A culture that helps those who embrace it rid themselves of the skepticism, which says nothing can be done when those who make the culture desire little for themselves and much for others. And in a sense, that Yurok that's been the ethos of Yurok. I had done this as a calling because I believed in music, and then I understood that people, what I did for them, what I sold to them, what I shared with them, made their lives bearable and gave their lives meaning. And I had so many artists tell me this, and so many people who got music from me, that if it wasn't for you, I don't know what I'd do. Well, now they can go to Amazon. Okay, so
yeah.
But that's the essence of what really music is. It's the if it may be the omnipotent power in the universe.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. I don't know. But I tend to think it has a power that we can't even quantify.
Sure. So in 1996, you produced a box set for Rhino, a supernatural fairy tale, the progressive rock era.
Yeah, that was a result basically of working at Green World. Because when I worked at Green World, I was a manager of part of the retail operation, and they hired a couple other guys. One of them was Brian Schumann, who worked in the warehouse, and we would eat lunch out in the grass and, you know, talk revolution or whatever it was we were talking. You know, we were just kind of revolting and upset. I don't know. Guys being guys. Well, he turned out to be the senior vice president of Rhino Records.
Yeah.
I took my number one son to college orientation, and we stopped by Rhino for lunch, and we had a chat, and he let me in the secret room and gave me some goodies, and he said, you know, we're thinking about doing a box set of the history of the progressive rock culture, but we don't know anybody to do it. You know, I'm saying, Brian, who are you talking to? He said, no, that's why I'm mentioning it to you. How would you like to do it? And I said, do dogs like fleas? Or, you know, no, they don't. Do dogs have fleas or whatever? I said, sure, yeah, I'd like to do it. It would be fantastic. He said, okay, here's what we want you to do. Once again, this cassette thing. Cassettes were at the root of so much. Go home, peruse your collection, and make for us 6 90-minute tapes of any music that you would love to put into this concept of progressive music. So I did that. I went home, and probably about a month later, I literally, all my records were in my, you know, palatial UROC office here in the basement. And I went through, and I made 6 90-minute cassettes, and I sent them to them. And as it turned out, they licensed 5 90-minute cassettes worth of music because certain bands, King Crimson, wouldn't allow it to be licensed, you know, and so forth and so on. And then they said, well, why don't you write us a book to go with it?
Yeah.
And I said, okay. So I wrote a 60-page libretto, and I got, photos from people overseas, and I wrote, you know, I included a piece by Manuel Goching, the Steeplechase Blues Band, and an early unreleased piece by Claude Schultz, and a Magma, and, you know, all kinds of UROC stuff. But I also wanted to make it so that people related to the fact that this is not just a bunch of weirdos out there. There is rock radio that had amazing records that sold a lot, like Radar Love by Golden Earring, and, you know, it was a conglomeration of underground, alternative, but music that I loved and thought was like, you know, everyone should love it, and actually they kind of did, you know?
Sure.
And turned out really well. The only negative side of that really was they picked a cover and by artwork by Yes, which was on there, of course. But when I met ELP and showed them, they weren't real happy because it was Yes and not ELP artwork, okay? So I don't know.
They wanted H.R. Geiger or something, H.R. Geiger cover.
Yeah. Rhino had the complete concept. They came up with the title Supernatural Fairy Tales, which, you know, I didn't think it was that great. It was an album by Art, you know, the band Art, later turned into Spooky Tooth. I mean, I liked it, and I liked the cover. I thought it was beautiful, laminate, but it was a little too Yes-y for me, too. But I thought it was a great box set. They did one run because it was really expensive and hard to license all of this stuff.
Yeah.
So it put out, I think, 10,000 copies, maybe. You can probably get some on Amazon. I think it's still up.
Yeah, I think I'm looking at Discogs right now because I need to get a copy. I didn't actually realize you had done that until I was preparing for this interview. I was like, that looks like a box set that needs to be out again.
Well, I've done a lot of stuff, and you know, really, I've done it in the underground.
Yeah.
You know, aside when I work for other companies, and it's been there and then it's gone. And
right.
So that's why I'm grateful for Frank for his vinyl on demand box, and, you know, for Brian at Rhino. There have been people that have all along the way have believed in what I did and related to what I did and sort of liked the personality that I had and said, you know what, take this idea and run with it. We want to do it however you want to do it. And it's worked, like, amazingly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So your, you know, your interest and your sort of your personal taste and then by extension the work you've done, for me it kind of blurs the lines that somebody might draw between experimental music, progressive rock, post-punk, punk, outsider music, avant-garde, experimental. You know, your work kind of encompasses all of that stuff. Is there a through line to you that runs sort of between all the music that you've championed? Is there one connecting thread, sort of? Or I know that's a little bit broad of a question, but I wonder if you've given thought to that.
Well, there's sort of let's put it this way. There's a connecting thread in my work, but there's a whole parallel thread, which is my personal listening, which I listen to anything and everything from Townes Van Zandt to Magma, okay?
So right.
My approach to music is like if I like it and if it speaks to me, then I listen to it. Now, with my work, surely this concept of the second culture it's definitive in terms of I don't know that anybody's ever really worked in this area and presented in the way that I presented over the span of all the years. And you're right, this whole concept of experimental and progressive and punk and outsider and avant-garde and everything, it was a gigantic pool of energy and music that was out there that people were experimenting with. And then when the internet and when all this came along, everything, as my latest book goes into, it all kind of changed. Now, for me, what really, honestly, there was two things that were like catalytic in my life, and one of them was being introduced to music in Russia and being told that I broke the blockade, the Soviet blockade, because I had records smuggled out of the country to me by an artist and by someone who was a deep sea diver, and I got them played on the radio, and I sold them, and I released them, and I promoted them.
Which artist was that there?
That was, first of all, the Plastic People, but most particularly Mikhail Chekalin and the label of Edward Artemyev and Artemy Artemyev. But
yeah,
the Chekalin music, his father was the pioneer. He was the main person who owns all the patents of the Saturn rocket, which was the first rocket ever launched into space. He had his own light and sound studio, and he recorded music and soundtrack films and albums of uncomparable, you want to call it ambient music, you want to call it experimental music, you want to call it avant-garde and classical. He epitomizes that. And
right.
I have done a lot of work with him in the past 10 years. And even more, not even more, but parallel to that is the work of Gilbert Artmann from France, Lard Free and Urban Sax, who I went and visited and did a performance in their studio, a book talk and so forth, where if you want to talk about all of the strands of the nebula of experimental ambient electronic and cosmic music coming into the future, that is what is happening in that regard. And if you witness an Urban Sax performance, if you watch an hour and a half video of Mikhail Chekalin's rescued footage from the Soviet era, you see something you've never seen before. You experience something that none of this other, you know, nebulous experience that led up to where I am and where music is now, it doesn't even compare to that, seriously.
Sure.
So that's why Yurok, for the next 5 years, are going to be devoted to another book on Urban Sax and a documentary of the entire 45-year existence of what I have done. And basically that will include footage of Urban Sax, Quad Sax, Chekalin, all of this stuff. And then you could probably ask me this question and I could hand you a copy of that and say, I tell you what, I know I can't explain it to you nearly as well as if you sit down and watch this and hear the stories and see what these artists have done and how I've been able to, like, make this happen for them.